Today on the 21st, as protests continue over the way police treat people of color, we're continuing our conversations on race in America. Educational psychologist Helen Neville returns to talk about racial trauma and the idea of treating racism as a public health problem. Then, educator and author Joseph Flynn says most white people agree racism is wrong, but are still afraid to truly confront it and understand it. A conversation with the author of White Fatigue. And we'll talk to a Chicago-area bookseller about some of the titles she recommends for people looking to broaden their understanding of race in America. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer last week is difficult to watch, but for black Americans especially, these incidents of violence can be mentally and emotionally exhausting, heartbreaking, and traumatic. It's also renewed calls that racism should be treated as a public health crisis. This week, the city of Cleveland in Ohio actually voted to do just that. Here to talk more about this is Helen Neville, a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. Professor Neville, welcome back to the 21st. And we seem to be having some technical issues connecting with Professor Neville.
Thank you so much.
You are here. Oh, great.
I'm okay. Sorry. Yeah, thank you so much.
No, that's all right. It happens. Thank you for being here. And I just want to remind our listeners that you can always join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. Well, and I should add, we are connecting on Zoom, so sometimes we do have these little digital hiccups. So, Professor Neville, thanks again for being here. And I want to begin by asking you about Cleveland. The city recently voted to declare racism a public health crisis. Do you think racism is a public health crisis?
Thanks a lot for inviting me back to come and talk about this incredibly important topic. And painful topic. And to answer your question, yes, I do believe that racism is a public health crisis. It has been for a long time. And it's not only a public health crisis, but it's an economic crisis. It's a whole range of things. And I'm sure that people probably are asking themselves, well, what does it mean to be a public health crisis? I mean, that's what I would be asking myself. And why would some folks be compelled to pass a resolution that talks about it as a public health crisis? And I'm happy to go into talking about my understanding about racism as a public health crisis, if you think that would be helpful to the listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Please do.
Some of the things is, I think, unfortunately, in our society, when we think about racism, people want to reduce racism to individual level prejudice, where somebody holds negative feelings or beliefs about somebody else. And that's just prejudice. That's not racism. Racism is really this racial prejudice, which is rooted in white supremacy and actual power to create disparate outcomes based on those belief systems. So it's important to understand that racism is not just an individual act, but it's part of these larger structural institutions.
And if I can just pause to ask you, because this is such an important point. And later in the show, we're hoping to bring our listeners a conversation with an author who's written about white fatigue and this related idea of white white fragility that's out there. And I think that I just want to drill down on what you're talking about, because I think that for many people, and I'll say this myself included, you know, we grew up with the idea that racism is something that's mean people do, or, you know, Bull Connor doing that sort of thing. And if we're not doing that, the idea, you know, it's abhorrent to people that then they're called part of a racist structure. And I'm glad you're sort of explaining this difference. And can you talk a little bit particularly about what you mean by white supremacy, right? We're not talking about skinheads here when you use that phrase.
Okay, great. That's a great idea. So there's a lot of what you've said that I would really like to unpack.
Sure.
But white supremacy is not just the belief and the ideology that white people are superior, but it's also in terms of their belief that Black and other people of color, indigenous folks and other people of color are inferior, that our cultural productions, that who we are inferior to whites. And therefore whites deserve to be more advantages. And so what does that look like in our society? It looks like who gets our language. Folks who speak African vernacular English are thought as that English is less than, not as intelligent. It's looked at in terms of our family structures, how we work, how we talk, how we interact, that it's the white way of doing things is the right way of doing things. And then that sets up a whole cascade of other institutional practices and policies that unfairly discriminate against Black folks, Indigenous folks, and other people of color that really get to this public racism as a public health crisis. What are those? Those would, the way that it looks right now in COVID-19, I'm sure people have been reading about the statistics. The New York Times recently ran an article a couple weeks ago, and in that article, it cites a research that talks about preliminary data where Black folks were 6 times less likely to get tested for COVID-19 and receive treatment for COVID-19 symptoms. It's this type of not understanding and being sympathetic to Black people's pain, to our symptoms, that lead to inequalities. And that's just one example of that. But racism then as a public health, crisis is related to the fact that we are in jobs right now that are racially segregated and that we're paid consistently less. We are now entering what's going to, you know, an economic crisis. And who's going to be hardest hit by that? It's going to be Black folks. It's not by our biology. It's by design. It's through racist and racialized practices. It's in our racial segregated housing. It's in our the criminal justice system. So the way that racism in our structure and racist institutions and structures promote inequality in which white folks benefit and people of color do not. And that's really, really hard for people to understand, especially if they want to just say that I've worked hard and therefore I deserve everything I get. Well, people of color work hard too, and they deserve to have economic prosperity. They deserve good jobs, good education. So it's really hard. I spent 20 years looking at this construct of colorblind racism or racial ideology. And that's really what's at play here, is that people want to deny or minimize or distort the significance of this structural level racism that's created inequalities that are the reasons why that people are in the street now uprising. Their anger over the inequalities in which Mr. George Floyd represents, Ms. Breonna Taylor, Mr. Ahmaud Arbery, and the list goes on. It's those deaths, but it's also the inequalities that Black people also are facing, this anti-Black racism. And when people don't see that, is what I'm calling, you know, when they deny that reality, they minimize it, that is colorblind racism. And folks who have higher levels of this colorblind racism, they don't think about race and racism, racism, that they then have less empathy for people of color. They're less empathic to our pain. They're more able to tolerate our suffering. And so by naming racism as a public health crisis allows us to name structural racism, what it's done to us contemporary, but historically, the pain that it's caused. And it also allows us to have conversations about what needs to be done and where we need to go from here.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Helen Neville, Professor of Educational Psychology and African American Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I want to ask you, so as we're talking about a public health crisis that racism is, this is also, it can be an individual mental health crisis for people as these images are played on the news again and again. Do you worry about how this affects, I mean, it's almost an obvious question, but I mean, how does this affect mental health? People, particularly for African-American people who are seeing these images, you know, play out on the media.
Thank you for asking that question. And it is a mental health crisis. I think there's not one Black person I have talked to that hasn't felt numb, nauseated, overwhelmed, fatigued, exhausted, unable to sleep, unable to concentrate. Not one. It is taking all of our bandwidth to stay present at this time. And so it's this repeated exposure to racism. It's looking and being exposed to that video repeatedly and knowing other people are being exposed to that. That takes an incredible toll on us. I personally have not watched the whole video of Mr. George Floyd and his murder. I have not watched that. I cannot see someone narrate their own death. But to see those images where they have that are everywhere, it's ubiquitous, where they have the knee on the officer has a knee on his neck, makes me cry every time I see that. And so sitting with that pain, where people are so callous that they could take our life the same way they would take the life of an animal, and dehumanize us in that way, it's hard not to connect with that. And what I'm seeing in the people that I talk to, it also then connects to anti-Black racism that they've experienced on their jobs, growing up, in their neighborhoods, in the stores. So it's triggering a whole host of trauma that has been accumulated over the years. And then there's also the intergenerational trauma that goes with this. So to know that our parents and our grandparents and their parents went through similar struggles, but they resisted those struggles, which gives us joy and hope. But it's very difficult and painful. It does play an incredible mental health toll on us at this moment.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, go ahead. Uh-huh. I would say this is not a unique experience, right? I understand you've studied the emotional reactions of college students to the killing of Trayvon Martin, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What we've done with that was to look at students and ask them how they felt hearing the verdict, or how they felt when they learned about the shooting, and how they felt after learning the verdict. And folks who were aware of racism, who understood the structural issues that exist in society, were the ones who felt the deepest pain. These are the ones who are empaths. And so of course it's gonna impact us. And so there is data suggesting that these kinds of events are having an impact on us psychologically. There's also some really interesting work done by Brandisha Tynes, who's at the University of Southern California. And she discussed and looked at these viral videos, much like the George Floyd video, but this was before the time. What impact do these viral videos that dehumanize Black folks and Latinx folks, what impact does it have on adolescents' psychological well-being? And she found that exposure to these videos are impacting adolescents' levels of depression and anxiety. So I think it's important to keep that in mind as well.
And I wonder, there's this idea, and we're getting close to the to needing to take a break here, and I hope you can stick around with us after that. But this is a bigger question than we have time to answer, but I want to begin this idea of fatigue coming from people of color, right? You hear this frustration that these police killings keep happening, and even in workplaces, this idea that it's somehow up to people of color to make their offices more diverse, and it's up to them to make sure that diverse voices are heard in conversations. And I think you hear people are really tired of having to do this work. And like I said, we have to take a short break here, but just if we can kind of begin to dig into that idea, to start that conversation in about a minute before our break, what do you think of that?
Yeah, thanks a lot for asking that. And some people will call that racial battle fatigue, that explains all that of exhaustion. I think it is important that people realize, one, that the Black colleagues are already in the moment experiencing this. It is not their responsibility to chart to take care of white folks and their guilt, to chart out a response, to help folks figure out how to move forward. That adds an added burden when people are already taxed. My recommendation is to encourage these units and employments to provide space for their Black colleagues to process the pain, for them to acknowledge the pain that people are going through, to connect with them as human beings, and then to pull together as white folks to then begin to say, what work do we need to do to begin to address this? Do we need a statement? What resources do we have or can we gain so that we can address this? So the onus of responsibility is not just on one or two people to address the pain that they're experiencing.
Okay, we're speaking with Professor Helen Neville. I hope you can stick around with us after the break, and we'll continue this conversation. Please join our conversation, 800-222-9455. You're listening to The 21st. More to come in just a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking about the idea of racial trauma and the idea of racism as a public health crisis in the wake of the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer last week. We're speaking with Helen Neville, a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. And a reminder that you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on the line from Tallulah, Illinois. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Well, listening to the conversation, and I'm hearing things I've heard many times before, like the catchphrase institutional and systemic racism. Mm-hmm. And I know I have a fairly good idea of what that means, but I know for white people not living in the same environment that Black people have to, it's very difficult for most white people to understand what that means. And if we could talk more about examples of the institutional and the systemic racism.
Okay.
What
thank
that
you.
Actually means, what those words mean.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Professor Neville, I wonder if you can respond to that.
Sure. I'm happy to take a look at that. I'll respond to that. The way it practically means is, let's give some examples. We know that African Americans are overrepresented in the jails and prisons here. We know that they are arrested they might have arrest rates, similar rates in terms of drug uses, but they're convicted at higher rates. They get, and also at conviction, they get steeper sentences. We know that Black folks say are dying of COVID-19 at disproportionate higher rates. We know that Black children are being suspended from school at higher rates. We know that no matter what decade we're in, Black folks on average will have unemployment rates twice that of white folks. And that would be whether you have Blacks with PhDs or Blacks with BAs, whatever the unemployment rate is for Blacks with PhDs, of people with PhDs, Blacks will have twice the unemployment rate that whites with PhDs. That in terms of at income, that Black folks in terms of income with a bachelor's degree on average are making something similar to what white folks are making with a high school diploma. So we know in terms of home ownership that we have lower home ownership. We know that there's lower wealth. So the question then becomes like, why does that exist? Why does that happen? How do you understand and how do you explain that? Since we know that race is primarily a social construction, it's not biological. So it's not something that Black people are doing to themselves. It's not that they don't want their children to succeed. It's not that people want to be incarcerated. There's something at play here. It's not that people want to die of COVID-19. And what's at play are these larger, which are many times unseen, social and political forces that create inequality through historic practices. I hope that makes sense. So, for example, mm-hmm. when we think about, let's just take housing, for instance. So, you know, Black folk, when the middle class was becoming middle class and owning homes, you know, through the GI Bill, they were able to get these great loans, move into these wonderful neighborhoods. Black GIs didn't have those same opportunities. And the loans were primarily going to white folks. So this is the creation of wealth, right? And so we were left out of that system. We have redlining where banks literally wouldn't give us loans if we lived in certain neighborhoods. So there's all kinds of systems and practices that create inequality. And they're based on how individuals who run institutions think about Black folks. I'm hoping that provides some clarity.
Yeah, definitely. And a reminder that this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Helen Neville, who is a professor of educational psychology and African-American studies at the University of Illinois. A reminder, you can always join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before the break, I want to return to this idea we were talking about, battle fatigue among people of color. And I wonder what white people, and I almost feel bad asking the question, right? Like, but what white people can do to support Black people right now who might be feeling this battle fatigue or even just feeling overwhelmed by everything that's happening in these images we were talking about earlier?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question, and thank you for asking that. I think there's a couple of things that white folks can do, white allies. One might be not to ask for conversations or whatever, but to send a text to their friends and colleagues to say, I've been thinking about you. This is a difficult time. I just wanted to know that I care about you. Just to let them know that they care about. So that's one small thing, but I don't want them to just then drop that. There is some work that I think white allies and co-liberators can do. One is to begin to really do some deep, serious education about white racism, white supremacy, white fragility, and the way that that shows up in their own lives and in the lives of their communities. And so to begin to read work, Janet Helms has done some really good stuff. There's some other research done on white fragility there's some good TED Talks on white fragility to begin to unpack that. I also think it's important to begin to understand racism, structural racism, and Black folks' experiences. I would say, looking into James Baldwin's work would be good. Ta-Nehisi Coates would be a good person to take a look at. And currently, there are a ton of webinars that are available. I want to point out one in particular. Intersectionality Matters. Kimberly Crenshaw, with her African American Policy Forum, has put together a series of webinars that are now also available as podcasts on the COVID-19 crisis and inequalities within that. She's interviewed guests from around the world that are experts in this area. And so people can so far she's had 10 or 11 episodes. This last episode happened yesterday, which she entitled Fire This Time, where they talked about the current crisis. And they also talked about the intersection between racism and gender, the fact that we're not speaking as much about, say, Breonna Taylor and working for her justice in that way. There's other folks that have also been women that have also been negatively impacted, so that we begin to understand their pain and humanize their stories. So I think white folks can also start to educate themselves and sensitize themselves around these particular issues. So one is to check in on their folks of color. Two is to start to do some intellectual work and to begin to unpack and educate themselves. And three, I really think to start to do some of the emotional work that comes along with that. For folks, it can range, folks can feel angry. I'm not like that. My ancestors didn't do that. Why should I do, and to start to unpack what that anger means. Others is to feel incredibly guilty. Part of the guilt has to do with, oh my goodness, this is going on. This is overwhelming. I don't know what to do with this. And they start to feel so overwhelmed that they shut down and not really address this. So I think this is the time to do some really deep emotional work to begin to confront the guilt, the anxiety, the concerns, but within their own groups, so that they're not overburdening their Black friends to try to take care of them. There's some really interesting work on that. I know Lisa Spanierman out of Arizona State University has done some really interesting work on the psychological costs of racism to whites. Her work minimizes the pain and suffering for Black folks, Indigenous folks, and other people of color, but just to show how white folks are negatively impacted by racism. It has this psychological toll, but then it also creates, problems that they don't have true intimate friendships with people of color. And I think we're wonderful folks to get to know. And so she starts to unpack that. And part of what she's getting at too is this idea of guilt. And what she has this interesting article that deals with white women tears and white men fears. So this idea that the way that guilt gets expressed among some white women, not all, but some, is through tears because it's so painful and guilty. It's so painful for folks, so they cry. But it's important you can lean into that crying, but not then to center your own pain at the expense of the pain of other people. that you yourself deal with the pain, but don't put the attention that your pain is the most important, because other people are really suffering now. And then the fourth thing to do so after dealing with the emotional stuff, dealing that within community, is to begin to find ways to be in service of community, to adopt anti-racist practices, and to support the work of folks on the ground doing work. So people don't need to be the leaders of this, but they can actually support the work through, if it's the financial things, such as giving to organizations that they believe in, whether it's the Bell Project, Bell Bond Project, or whether it's Black Futures Lab, or whether it's your local organization. I mean, begin to really think about, what are your values and how do you want to practice anti-racism in your action? But you can't skip to the action piece. You can't go all the way to action, let me donate some money or let me show up, if you haven't done some of this intellectual and emotional work, because what will happen is you might then further create harm with the people that you wanted to be in community with through various forms of microaggressions.
Mm. And that, I mean, that's, and we have about 4 minutes left in our conversation, and then we're actually going to be talking to a bookseller from the Chicago area about sort of a recommended reading list to start to do some of this intellectual work that you're talking about. And I should remind people, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're speaking with Professor Helen Neville, Professor of Educational Psychology and African American Studies at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. You can always join our conversation, 800-222-9455. And in just the few minutes we have remaining, I want to ask you about something we noticed on your Twitter account. And this is the idea of allies. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what we see now from sort of the corporate, you know, the business world out there, in terms of, you know, everybody is putting out their statements and trying to calibrate, you know, how they want to get on this. Can you talk about, you know, some of the things you've seen? I know the Paw Patrol, which is, if people don't have young kids, this is a cartoon show about this team of search and rescue dogs. They said they were muted in listening on their social media account and were pretty widely mocked for that. Maybe you can talk about an example of this the right way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I think one of the issues, I think folks now are saying some of the statements are hollow and template. I think people view the statements that are most impactful is if, one, they name what the issue is. I know Ben and Jerry's named the issue as being white supremacy. So name it in terms of white supremacy, anti-Black racism, institutional racism, whatever that it might be. I think so the first is to name it. Then the second is to acknowledge the way in which these have impacted of the development of our country and resulted in some of the current uprising. Third is to acknowledge the pain and suffering that this has caused. Fourth, then, to identify that the company is not only in solidarity, but they are also taking direct action to begin to address these concerns. And these direct action could entail reflection on the policies of the particular association organization to see if there are ways that they inadvertently are discriminated against folks, mm-hmm. to increase the diversity of their organization. To begin to look at look at whiteness and what that means, and begin to interrogate that, and to take actions to promote equity within their specific institution and nationally.
Okay. Professor Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where she researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. Professor Neville, this has been so enlightening. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And just a programming note, I did just say a few moments ago we were going to bringing you a segment with a bookseller. sort of a recommended reading list for people who want to learn more about racism and race in America. And unfortunately, we've just learned that our guest is not going to be able to join us today. We will bring you that conversation. We hope to bring you that conversation next week. So stay tuned. This is the 21st. We're instead going to be going with an encore segment. I'm Brian Mackey. More to come in just a moment. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the coronavirus has continued to spread, so too have the number of scammers looking to profit off the pandemic. Local and federal authorities are warning about fake miracle cures, con artists promising financial relief, and store owners jacking up prices on hot commodities like toilet paper. In early April, we spoke with Brett Chase about this. He's a reporter for the Better Government Association. At the time, the Federal Trade Commission had gotten hundreds of fraud complaints related to the coronavirus. As of this week, the FTC had logged more than 28,000 fraud complaints related to the outbreak. Back in April, I started by asking Brett if it's common to see an uptick in scams around a disaster scenario.
There's always scams around big disasters, hurricanes, floods, things like that. This, of course, is unlike anything we've ever seen. These are complaints that are going to, you know, make their way to the federal government. Sometimes if you call Better Business Bureau, they're going to, you know, they're going to contribute to that database. But, you know, separately, we have local communities taking fraud complaints. We have the state taking fraud complaints. You have a whole array of government agencies at the federal level that are, you know, taking complaints because these scammers are using anything they can to, you know, to try to make themselves look legitimate, whether they're posing as Medicare or as, the FEMA, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of promises to get those stimulus checks if you just, you know, give them some personal information. So there's a whole bunch of things going on right now.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. So there have been, scams involving these stimulus checks. There's a $2.2 trillion in the Federal CARES Act. So what sort of fraud are we talking about as related to these, you know, fake federal aid scammers?
You might get a phone call. You might get a text. You might get, you know, an email. You know, there's all sorts of things like that. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, you're probably not getting as much, you know, in mail, you know, snail mail, but, you know, you're going to get these legitimate looking emails. You know, they look like they're coming from, you know, a trusted government agency or some trusted, you know, organization. You might get, you know, you'll get a lot of direct calls. I've talked to people who got, you know, direct calls and, you know, even a text, you know, hey, you know, contact us. We've got your money, or we got you know, some masks, or we got a cure, or, you know, there's all sorts of stuff.
And this is not the sort of thing that I would imagine inspires your local police department to snap to attention and deploy all their resources, right?
I think they're going to be busy with a lot of other stuff right
yeah.
now. Honestly, you know, so I mean, I'm here in Chicago, and city of Chicago, you know, asks people to call 311. But in some of those, you know, those complaints then get funneled to a consumer affairs department here. And then at the state level, you've got the Illinois Attorney General, and they're fielding a ton of price gouging complaints right now. Not as much of the consumer fraud that I just mentioned, but, you know, just like 1,300, you know, I mean, 1,300 and counting, I should say, complaints of price gouging compared to, you know, not very many. I don't have the exact number at the state level, but just for comparison's sake, you know, City of Chicago fielded 2 price gouging complaints in all of 2019. In March and through the early part of April, they had more than 400 complaints.
A little quick math, that's a, from, what, 200,000% increase? I don't know. It's like that is a 200-fold increase.
Big.
Yeah. So yeah. What sort of price gouging are we talking about? Do you have any examples here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, boxes of toilet paper going from $50 to $80. You know, we've got, you know,
$80 for a case of toilet paper. Wow.
I will I will give you the caveat that, you know, these are allegations.
Sure.
You know, I talked to a store owner on the south side of Chicago who said, you know, I was never actually selling this for $80. I was joking to a customer that I'm not going to sell, you know, my entire inventory. I'd have to charge you a crazy amount of money. But then, interesting enough, he showed me a receipt, and we put this in our story, a receipt from his supplier. And sure enough, he paid $50 for 36 rolls of toilet paper, you know, which he said was more than double what he normally buys from this wholesaler. So that was an interesting, you know, proof that some of this stuff is going on.
Yeah, wow, that is an incredible price. But I mean, I guess this is, I've heard stories of people, you know, with chickens trading eggs for toilet paper. I mean, people are getting desperate for this product.
We're paying up, and some of that is going to be, you know, somewhat legitimate. But, you know, I mean, the governor has said, you know, you're not going to profit off of this. You know, it's this. I mean, there's the state of Illinois is going after this a couple different ways. I mean, there's already consumer fraud, you know, and price gouging laws on the books. But then, in addition, you know, with the governor's disaster declaration, then that gives the state a little bit more, you know, teeth on this matter. Although I will say that with this big influx, the Illinois Attorney General's office tells me is that, you know, they're trying to just, you know, mitigate as much as they can.
Yeah.
You know, they're not prosecuting it right now. They're calling businesses. They're like, you know, if you're price gouging, better knock it off. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, or we're looking at you. And so there haven't really been any prosecutions, and even, like here in, you know, Chicago's a big city, you know, there's only been like a couple citations, or at least at the time of publication, there were only, you know, a couple citations. It's, you have like a handful of people, in this case, you know, going out and trying to check these stores. And of course, when they get there, well, you know, those $50 boxes of toilet paper are already sold out. So, you know, there's a lot of hysteria too. I mean, people are. You know, are hitting the phones because they feel like they're getting ripped off. And, you know, but it does seem like there's enough out there that there is, you know, some legitimate price gouging going on.
Yeah. And the last thing real briefly, I want to ask you about are miracle cures, right? Teas, vaccines. Is that kind of thing happening as well?
Yeah. And I don't, you know, again, I don't have like a concrete example of it happening in Illinois other than, well, I mean, you know, talking to the Better Business Bureau, I mean, they've been getting complaints about it. They're investigating. These investigations can take a while. At the federal level, they've moved fairly swiftly on some of these matters, like the Federal Drug Administration. Anytime you have sort of, you know, these false medical claims, they're going to get involved. And they and the FTC jumped on some of these things, including some pretty notable people like Jim Baker, the former televangelist who went to jail all those years ago. He has a TV show where he was he's touting this like silver cream, and he said that this was gonna. I saw that you can Google it and see the video online.
Yeah.
He was saying that, you know, this stuff's gonna take care of that COVID-19. So FDA and FTC said, you know, you need to knock that off. And
yeah,
they did.
Wow. All right. Brett Chase is a senior investigator for the Better Government Association. He's been telling us about the thousands of fraud complaints that federal and local officials have gotten during the coronavirus pandemic. I also want to welcome into the conversation Terry Warman, who's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Illinois. She's on the line with us now. Terry, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Terry, we've been talking to Brett, and I'm bring him back in a moment, but I'm sure none of what we've been talking about comes as a surprise to you, right? We've seen an uptick in scams along with the pandemic, but elderly people who are older adults, they're often targeted for scams year-round. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, really, the scammers like to really capitalize on the news of the moment. And whether you're a senior or almost all of us, I mean, we're at home, we're high anxiety, we're really, you know, we're wanting information, we're wanting to make sure that we're all safe. And so the scammers are just taking advantage of that. And some of the things that they have done over the years, they're doing it again. And now it's just under the guise of COVID-19 and the pandemic.
And is there... Do you think, is there a stigma to reporting this kind of fraud? Is there any sort of sense of maybe shame at having been tricked or something like that? And what do you say to people who find themselves in that position?
Well, certainly. And we know that for many older adults, or probably even you or I mean, if we really fell for something and going, oh, why did I do that? But yeah, there's a whole lot of fear about reporting it. Oftentimes, people also have just a hard time being able to tell what is a scam and what's not. And because we are in a heightened state of anxiety, that our logical brain stops sometimes when we hear something instead of stepping back, where we just get pulled into it. And so, yeah, there are a lot of examples of scams. Our AARP Fraud Watch Network helpline has been getting a whole lot of examples of those kinds of things that are happening.
Just real briefly, can you give me one quick example of like what does a scam look like now in the COVID-19 pandemic?
Obviously, they're playing to the fears around face masks, because certainly seniors, you know, they want the potential block to be the store or whatever, but they don't even know where to get masks. And so getting an email or a phone call that says, you know, you can get these products from us. The whole idea of one of my volunteers actually sent us, there's a text that's going around. Says someone who came in contact with you tested positive or has shown symptoms for COVID-19 and recommend you self-isolate or get tested. And there's a link that's a scam. And the link, if you click on it, you know, they're potentially going to be asking for information, et cetera. And so people being very careful on clicking any sort of email links, text links, you know, offering treatments, you know, go here, and donations, charities is kind of a big thing right now. And so people can actually check on charities by going to the Better Business Bureau, their www.give.org, for example. You can go and check them. And then if I might offer, AARP has our toll-free helpline at 877-908-3360, and you can be a person of any age. You don't have to be a member. You just want to check something out. You want to report something. They're taking those calls, and they can do it in multiple languages. So better safe than sorry in this particular instance.
Okay. And Brett, just in about 30 seconds here, I mean, is you kind of mentioned that the Attorney General's office, at least in terms of the price gouging, is not doing a lot of prosecuting. Is anyone investigating these kind of scam complaints right now? And again, in about 30 seconds?
I think there's a lot of organizations, you know, from the FBI to the FTC to, you know, I mentioned the FDA and in a Better Business Bureau, which has been mentioned. I mean, they're looking into these things as well. So, yeah, there's a real joint operation going on, I'd say.
That's Brett Chase. He's a senior investigator for the Better Government Association. We also heard from Terry Warman. She's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Illinois. I spoke with both of them back in April. That's all we have time for, but before we go, I just want to remind our listeners that as we continue to cover developing stories, you can help us shape our news coverage. Just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730 to join our new texting initiative. Again, the word is TALK. Send it to 217-803-0730. We'll be in touch. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just follow us at 21STShow. That's 21st Show. We're also on Facebook. Search for The 21st. All of those links, every other way to connect with us, is at our website, 21stshow.org. You can also find all of our past shows there and everywhere you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Ryan Wild. Our intern is Zaini Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is produced by Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.